Calcio Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the Friday episode of the Calcio Land Podcast. So I named this episode after something that one of our guests said today, our friend Giulio Dicenza. He described this Serie A race coming down to a battle of nerves. So that's going to be a little bit of a theme of the podcast today. The other theme of the podcast is, if you tuned in last week, we had our dear friend Alex Goldberg going on a great rant on how Mendy had surpassed Donnarumma. So we're going to give him a little bit of crap on that. Also on the patron side of things, we have, as I mentioned, Giulio Dicenza. We're going to talk about the Scudetto race and a little bit about Genoa. I also had my good friends Matt Lichtenstatter come on. He wrote an excellent article for our patron page on what Conte has done at Spurs. Anyone who's listened to the pod knows that Conte has been a big character on our show for a while. And then at the end of the show, we're going to close on Alice in Chains. I got to see Jerry Cantrell in Boston on Wednesday. It was a great, great show. But, you know, we have to start with our dear friend Alex Goldberg. Last Friday, I thought you had an epic rant on Mendy. I really, really enjoyed it. So I got to ask you this. If you could have Donnarumma at Chelsea today, would you take him?
Oh, the cheekiness. Well, really, it was a poor time rant. I can't lie. That was, as I wrote on Twitter when it happened, after he made the true big blunder for Benzema's third goal, his hat trick. That was the lowest point in his Chelsea career, which really has been high, high, high. I'm not going to bore you with his whole career at Chelsea, but I will just say, I mean, 7 goals this week. That is certainly something that if he hadn't been so amazing for Chelsea all this time, he'd be getting killed, David. Absolutely killed, because it wasn't just the blunder, like you could argue, like we do for Donnarumma. You could argue on even some of the other goals. Could he have been positioned better? Could he have done better? I think the first two by Benzema, just for anybody who actually watched the game, they're incredible headers. Just incredible headers.
He's amazing.
Just ridiculous. He's the best at heading the ball in the game right now. Like, Ronaldo's just not doing it as frequently, you know? So Benzema is just pulling off ridiculous header after ridiculous header. But also, I mean, Benzema scored a hat trick against Donnarumma, David, and now Mendy in back-to-back games. So honestly, David, to just answer this very quickly, and I cannot believe I'm saying this, like, I still think Mendy's better than Donnarumma right now. Right now, I think they're both obviously top keepers. But who's the best keeper in the world right now? I think it was the guy that Mendy was facing, Thibaut Courtois. Like, what a freaking save.
Wow, Alex, what is happening here?
I'm dead.
What is happening?
I'm dead inside, David. So what do you want me to say? I mean, like, I might as well just sell my soul completely to the devil here.
Wow.
But it's just, like,
I never thought I would hear that. Amazing.
Amazing. But, like, ask a Real Madrid fan, besides Benzema, why they're still in everything, why they're going to be winning La Liga, why they're still in the Champions League, once again, besides Benzema. Courtois, he saves them over and over and over. The save he had on Azpilicueta's long shot was otherworldly. And you know what? Like, ever since that bad season, the debut one he had for Real Madrid, he's been a top keeper again. And look at his resume. It's really effing good. So I can make all my jokes about reptiles out and everything, but he has sustained a long period of being a top keeper. So with Donnarumma and Mendy kind of being vulnerable right now, he might take it. I don't know, David. I don't know who I am anymore. But no, I would not take Donnarumma at Chelsea today, because I still do think Mendy is the guy. But yeah, I'm feeling
certainly. I know that
weird.
Game was difficult for you. Like, I tweeted, you know, it's the George Costanza things, worlds were colliding. I've known you long enough. I know how much you love Benzema. So that must have been a little bittersweet. But let's switch gears. Let's get into Serie A. Another thing we talked a lot about last weekend, Alex, is that on paper, we thought there was a chance that Milan could really accelerate in the Scudetto race, and the exact opposite happened. Inter beat Juve. Napoli, I got to give them a lot of credit, answered the bell against Atalanta, and then Milan struggled. So I got to ask you this. How differently do you look at the Scudetto race this week compared to last. And because the theme of the show is a little bit this battle of nerves, you know, you're friendly with quite a few players, you know, kind of their mentality and all. When you look at this situation and the landscape in Serie A, do you think the schedule, the opponents are very important, or does it really come down to how the three contenders left are going to perform?
Yeah, I'm glad you ask it like that, because I think normally when you've asked this question before, I would really dive into the schedule for, in this case, I guess you could now just say the three remaining teams. You know, I'd want to compare and contrast the schedule so hard, like who has the strongest, who has the weakest between Milan, Napoli, and Inter. But I really do think it's more about the latter part of what you said there in the question. I really do think it's about how they're performing and, you know, really just how much confidence they have as a side, because down the stretch, I think when the games do get extra pressurized, right, confidence is really going to get you over the hill. And these teams, I'm sure there's going to be discrepancies in how some perform on the road versus at home, but really Milan, Napoli, and Inter are all capable of getting the result on the road against a good team, at home against a good team, but also slipping up. Like, they absolutely are. And there's really not a whole lot that separates these clubs. There really isn't. I mean, what an absolutely massive win for Inter that was away to Juve. And I guess that's kind of my point. Like, Inter can have a big win away to Juve, and then they can at home draw against Fiorentina. And it's just kind of one of those things where, all right, if they're playing well, Inter, and if they're kind of playing how they were at the beginning of the season, David, when a lot of people had them winning the league again, then it really doesn't matter the schedule. Like, they're good enough. They're absolutely good enough. So, you know, I definitely think that's the case for Inter. They have the best goal differential in the league. So they have the artillery. It's just about how they're performing, how they're clicking. And perhaps that win kind of catapults them into a really good vein of form. You know, Napoli is really the similar case, in my opinion. You know, what a huge win that is away to Atalanta, 3-1, right? And then you have a at-home win before that against Udinese, and then another road win right before that against Verona. So, like, they're showing us, David, can be a dangerous opponent like Atalanta, maybe two lesser teams like Udinese and Verona. But whether it's home or away, if they're performing well, they can beat anyone. And we know Napoli, like, they can really be a well-drilled team. And I almost feel like, and this is just from an outsider's perspective, I could be wrong. Like, you know, I'm not on Serie A Twitter as much as yourself and our listeners, but I almost do feel like Napoli could have a case of, hey, everyone kind of forgets about us here. I know we're second, but like, the constant talk, at least once again from an outsider's perspective, is the two Milans. AC Milan, they have it right now. Can Inter get back into it? I don't personally hear enough talk about Napoli and them winning it, even though they're right there to win it. They have the second best goal differential. So I wonder if Napoli feels any of that. I could be once again totally wrong because I'm on the outside looking in, but you know, I do almost feel like Napoli could have a chip on their shoulder in that way. And then Milan, I mean, so solid, so good. And at this point, Milan is also a team that, you know, they've had really a nice long unbeaten streak, David. I mean, maybe too many draws for their liking, but they're hard to beat. Like, they're really, really hard to beat. And they also have the elder statesmen in Giroud and Zlatan, who maybe at this point in the season can get them over the hump. They need to start scoring more goals, David. That's for sure. But maybe if they explode now, like, I don't think they've scored two goals in a game since Salernitana in February, I want to say. So, like, maybe that breaks out of them. So I really do think it's about how they're performing and not the schedule. And I'm glad you once again asked it like that, because I think I've learned from my past mistakes where I really analyze the schedule too much. And then it's football. Anything can happen. You go through, well, that's going to be a win. That's going to be a loss. That's going to be a draw. And then they win the game that you gave them a loss for, and they lose the game that you gave them an easy win for. You know what I mean? So I think in this situation, they're just all too close in the trajectories, and it's just going to come down to who carries the momentum and confidence. That's my take on it. What about you?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, and this is one something that I've been thinking a lot about. This season, we only had two managers in the league that had won the Scudetto before, and that was Allegri and Mourinho, and Roma was not considered to be a serious Scudetto contender. I would say Roma are kind of exactly where they should be in the standings. So you're coming down to three managers that have a lot to prove, and each of them have some question marks, especially in the second half of the season. So it's a fascinating race. I do look at it very differently from last weekend. As I think you make a really good point on Napoli, because obviously in a lot of ways, the headline from last week was Inter beating Juve in controversial fashion. So that's always going to get a ton of attention. But Napoli rising to the challenge without Osimhen, there were other starters missing. The Di Lorenzo injury really could hurt him because he's been playing really well. I think that was a really big statement from him. Now, if you wanted to be a Napoli skeptic, you would also point out, well, Atalanta, especially at home, have not been very good, but they've had Napoli's number in recent years. So fascinating. Another thing to consider, and, again, it's easy to be prisoner of the moments because Milan was doing well. Giroud was kind of carrying them with some huge goals. But I did see Giuseppe Pastore, who we had on, had this tweet saying that Milan has only one goal, like inside the box, like something like 360 minutes. So you could say that maybe some of their wins were a little bit fluky, that maybe the Pioli slow down at the end of the season's here, but they're still kind of capitalizing anyway, sometimes with, you know, a little bit of luck, and they've had a lot of bad luck. And, you know, I don't try to talk about referee decisions too much, but they've definitely had some go against them. So I think it's a fascinating race. I do think that Inter win against Juve from a confidence standpoint, key for them, but, you know, for them, it comes down to a, there are two strikers who I thought played very well the first half of the season for different reasons are in a slump. Zeko's obviously older, and it feels like as great as he was in the first half of the season, he's running out of the gas. Lautaro's really streaky. I would say that, you know, if Lautaro can get going again, then I think Inter really do have a leg up. The fact that they do have this game in hand against Bologna, and Bologna did well against Milan, you know, maybe isn't a given. So they have that going for them. We'll see. It really is going to be a fascinating race. So I think you'll really enjoy getting Giulio Di Cienzo's take in a little bit. But let's get 2,000 names. We have some great games this weekend in Serie A. So as you guys know the drill, he sent me three games, and I'll make picks as well. So first off, we have Napoli hosting Fiorentina. Should be a very exciting game. 1,000 names has Napoli winning 3-1, goals by Osimhen, Mertens, Lozano, and Ikoné for Fiorentina. He said Ospina is going to save a penalty, and he's going to said even Italiano is going to give up facing Spalletti, and that De Laurentiis is already thinking about the Derby of the Sud with La Bari, which I'm fascinated. In Italy now they refer to Bari as La Bari. I remember it as Il Bari, but in any event, we didn't talk about it last week, but I do want to give credit to De Laurentiis, who had purchased Napoli when they were in the fourth division and they were bankrupt, and they are Scudetto contenders now. The other club he owns is Bari, and they were in the lower divisions. And Bari, if you're old school Serie A fan, you do remember them from back in the day in Serie A in the 90s, and now they're back to Serie B. So kudos to them. He's done a great job there. In Italian, Napoli, Fiorentina, 3-1, Simon, Mertens, Lozano, Ikoné, Ospina para rigore, anche Italiano si arrende al Casatiello meccanico di Spalletti. I gotta be honest, I'm not sure what Casatiello meccanico means, so I couldn't translate it. I always love learning new things in Italian. And then De Laurentiis pregusta già il derby del sud con la Bari. Fiorentina can be a tough customer. This should be an interesting game. I wonder how Napoli are going to respond after beating Atalanta. They do get Osimhen back. I'm going to have faith in them. I'll go Napoli 1-0, and I'm going to give Lozano the goal here. I'll agree with 1,000 names. Then we have Lazio traveling to Marassi to play Genoa. 1,000 names has Lazio winning 2-0, Acerbi, Milinkovic-Savic, Sarri spegne I sogni di gloria di Blessing. So he's saying Sarri is going to end Blessing's dreams. And Ciro is going to continue to be in the race for the capocannoniere race with getting inexistent penalties. In Italian, Genoa Lazio 0-2, Acerbi Milinkovic Savic, Sarri spegne i sogni di gloria di Blessin, Ciro sempre più capocannoniere a suon di gol inesistenti. I want Genoa to avoid relegation, so I'm actually going to be bold. I'll have them winning 1-0 and I'll give a goal to Yeboah, their young striker. Last game, Juve traveling to Sardinia to face Cagliari. Ooh, I wonder what's going to happen with Moise Kane and the fans there. 1,000 names, Cagliari winning 1-0. Goal by Dalbert. He says Cuadrado is going to miss a penalty. And that Allegri is going to smell on his neck Mourinho's breath. And that Mazzarri is going to go back to believing he can win. He can avoid relegation by playing Catenaccio. And that Cecchesi is going to have a disastrous mistake. In Italian, Cagliari, Juve 1-0. Dalbert, Cuadrado sbaglia rigore. Allegri sente il fiato sul collo di Mourinho. Mazzarri torna a credere alla salvezza col suo calcio in chiusa. Cecchesi disastroso. It's actually a return to Sardinia also for Allegri. I'll go 1-1 and I'll give a goal to Vlahovic and João Pedro to give our listeners a perspective on the other matches. Inter hosts Hellas Verona. Milan travel to Turin but to face Torino. So that should be exciting this weekend with Serie A. So let's continue the talk on the Scudetto race with our dear friend Giulio Di Cenzo. You guys know I love Vox to Box. Had a really good time doing this interview. We actually did it via video. You'll just hear the audio version. And Giulio really fell in love with my cat, Luna, which was very cool. So as always, I love Giulio's energy. I think you'll really enjoy this. Very excited to welcome our next guest. Perfect for what's going on in calcio now. We have a superb Scudetto race. We have a very interesting battle to avoid relegation. Genoa, a club near and dear to all of us, is on a resurgence. So I had to have our good friend Giulio Di Cenzo come back on. Everyone who's listened to Calcio Land for a while has heard Giulio before. He's one of the fantastic hosts of Vox to Box, by far my favorite calcio podcast. And Vox to Box now has like a podcast empire. So we'll get into that at the end with Giulio, but we're going to talk some calcio first. So Giulio, it's always a real pleasure to chat calcio with you. Bentornato to Calcio Land.
Thank you. Thank you. You're always so kind. And it's our friendly, your friendly neighbor killer of the English language speaking.
Awesome. Okay, Giulio. So I want to start here. And I feel like last weekend was a very interesting in the Scudetto race because on paper, it felt like Milan could really make a big step forward. And then pretty much the opposite happened. So let me ask you this. How differently do you look at the Scudetto race since Tuesday after Milan-Bologna compared to the week before?
Honestly, a lot. I mean, I always knew that there was an imbalance between the first positions. But Inter's victory, in my perception, has switched the momentum, as we say in the English language. Milan is still the lead. That is an important fact that in these days appears a little bit forgotten. This season Serie A will be a race until the last day. Without the 3 points against Juventus, it was something similar that Inter abused the race. So it was a very important weekend for Serie A.
For sure. So let's build on that. So after this weekend, look, I didn't think Juve were in the Scudetto race, but they're definitely out now because now they really can't get into more than 81 points. So they won't win. So it comes down to like these three teams. And I find it very interesting because we have three managers that, you know, are not, don't have a ton of experience in these races. So I want to ask you, between Spalletti, Pioli, who you've both had at Inter, and now Inzaghi that has been at Inter, who do you think has the advantage having the manager in this Scudetto race?
But for a career perspective, I have to say Spalletti because he's the more experienced manager about above the three, and also Napoli is a very qualitative team. But then you have to play. We know that Spalletti won a championship in Zenit in Russia, but in Serie A he always showed some problems to get to the final result. So it will be interesting who will win Serie A this season, will make a huge step forward in his career. For Spalletti, it will be a final accomplishment or something like that. And instead for Pioli and Inzaghi, it simply means that his career will be skyrocketed. And for Pioli, it will be a huge accomplishment. And nobody expected this a year and a half ago. So it will be an important accomplishment and something surprising.
Yeah, I agree, because I think Spalletti, you're right, he did win in Russia, but in Italy he also has been known for kind of at the end messing up. So it's really fascinating there. So I want to ask you this, because you've come on the pod, you've used some great Italian words, so feel free to use one here. If you had to use a word to describe this Scudetto race, what would it be?
Ma I don't have a single word, but è una battaglia di nervi, a battle of nerves, because as I told you before, this year Serie A will be decided in the last days. So for each team is important to stay focused. Every team will be battling for the titles until the last days. So it's not easy to keep the concentration until the last days. And as we told before, we have three young managers with little experience in this kind of races. So it will be difficult to maintain the focus in the last days. We see that it's easy to lose, come si dice fiducia in inglese?
Confidence.
The confidence, thank you so much. It's easy to lose confidence. We see Inter that seems to have a clear path to the Scudetto, then lost a lot of points and something like that. So the last days, it will be a battle of nerves.
I love the battaglia di nervi is a good one. No, because two, again, on paper, last weekend was supposed to be huge advantage Milan. So do you kind of agree that maybe the schedule doesn't matter as much as the mentality of the teams themselves? Because I really think that. I don't think last weekend was a fluke. I think that's kind of how it is. And it sounds like you kind of agree.
Yes, I agree. Also because we see that both Milan and Inter, for example, they lost points to the Genoa, Salernitana, Udinese, so the team in the last part of the league. So everything is possible, plain and simple.
For sure. So let's zero in on the teams. You know, you have an allegiance to Inter, but you are pretty objective. So let me ask you this. If you could take two players away from Milan and Napoli, not necessarily to put them on Inter, but more because you think these are really important players to these teams. If you could magically take two players away from Spalletti and Pioli, who would they be and why?
In Milan, for me, it's pretty simple because I have to tell Rafael Leao, because it's the main offensive threat of Milan. His simple presence creates problems to the defense of the opposing team, and he's always able to create something from nothing. So it's a really important resource for Milan, especially in the first minute of the game. And then I have to tell Mike Maignan, because I have a problem with my goalkeeper, and so I had to tell him. But we also see that Maignan is a resource for AC Milan game. We have against Sampdoria, he created an assist, so he's a very important player, not only for his ability in the goalkeeping. And for Napoli, I have to tell one of my favorite players, Fabian Ruiz, that is the soul of the midfield of Napoli and one of the most underrated player or underspoken player of Serie A, in my opinion. And then Osimhen, because his ability in goal scoring, in his offensive presence, is something very, very important. Also, with all the problems and the general unlucky events that happens to him.
Yeah, I think Fabian Ruiz, he's had a really great comeback season. He wasn't that great last year. I think he's really been great. Do you think Spalletti has a lot to do with Osimhen going up a notch and Fabian Ruiz improving? Do you think he's got a little bit to do with that?
But with Fabian Ruiz, for sure, because Spalletti has valorized a lot of midfielders. You think about Brozovic, Nainggolan, Pjanic, and so he's particularly able to get in touch with this kind of players. With Osimhen, is a matter of the technical qualities and physical abilities in Serie A. A player with his skills, his speed, his physical power in Serie A can make a huge difference, and we've seen it when he plays. But it doesn't happen a lot.
Okay, last question before we get to the really important subject, which is Genoa, of course. I want to ask you, do you think Milan and Napoli have a player that is as important to them as Brozovic is to Inter? Because we saw that when Brozovic is not there, and this was true even before Inzaghi, in my opinion, but do you think there's a player on each of those teams that is as important to win as Brozovic is to Inter?
The two teams have more important players, but I don't think at the same level, because we've seen, as you told, that Brozovic is irreplaceable in Inter game. Both Milan and Napoli had injuries in nearly every position in this year, and both of them managed to overcome the problems. When Brozovic was absent in the Inter formation, we saw always a lot of problems, and Inzaghi keep changing his team to try to overcome the difficulties, and was never able to do so. So there is not a player important as Brozovic in the other teams.
Yeah, no, I definitely think that's the case. Okay, let's get to Genoa. And this has been a very, even for their standards, a very rocky season. Got off to really a terrible start. They bring in Blessin, I don't think hardly anyone had heard of him. You know, in Italy, there's not a big tradition of bringing in foreign coaches, especially one that's never been heard of. So what did you make of his appointment? What stands out to you about the way Genoa plays under him?
No, first thing first, I have to, about Blessina, I have to recommend the last episode of Box to Box Patreon, because in the Momento Maioli, Marco spoke about Blessin and with a collection of articles about him that are so much fun. But I was surprised by Blessin, by his figure, by his impact. And the only one who believes in that is the amministratore, insomma, il dirigente del Genoa that hires him,
and the sporting director,
thank you so much, of Genoa, that knows him from Lipsia. The impression about Blessing is huge, because he came to Genoa with little experience. He just trained a year and a half, and he hasn't any experience in Serie A, but neither at high level, because he trained Ostende, and his main accomplishment was the creation of Tiat, the Bologna defender. He proved a huge ability to have an impact, an immediate impact on the team, because he came up with a lot of problems. The season already started, and he changed everything in Genoa. He gives a soul to his team. He created a solid system, and he has a problem that with the quality of the team, but it's not depending on him.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about the relegation race in general. I have to tell you, although Venezia has one less game than Genoa and they have the same points, I think Venezia are in big trouble, and I think they're going to go down with Salernitana. I think it's going to come down to Genoa and Cagliari. I'm not sure if you agree, but what percentage chances would you give to Genoa to avoid relegation?
The problem with Genoa is the goal scoring. If they somehow manage to score some goal, then they can avoid relegation, but it will be just as we say for the title race in the last days. Venezia is in a very, very difficult position, because as we say in Italy, i nodi vengono al pettine, and I mean that Venezia had some statistics that
it caught up to them, right?
Show like some problems from the start of the year, and now they are paying a lot, everything they are not able to do. And especially they have some problems in creating attack. They need desperately Henry, but they should need Thierry Henry, not Thomas. And that they have a problem in nearly every sector of the field. And we lost Gianluca Busio. And also, this is a strange factor. Yes, it is the most dangerous team, the team most in danger in this moment. But Genoa needs to score some goals and to find someone to score goals. But also, Cagliari is in a difficult position because after a period in which Mazzarri's solutions appear to were effective, now they are falling to their limits, also if D'Alberto is trying to do everything to save this team.
Who knows, maybe I'll have D'Albert back at Inter next season.
I'm really excited to have D'Albert back. We cover two positions that we really need.
Mazzarri has totally revolutionized the way he played. So, Giulia, I love talking calcio with you because it kind of really reminds me of like being back in Italy. And you guys at Box to Box have been doing an amazing job. You guys went to Patreon last year. It's become a huge success. I love that you've taken, you know, some of the segments that you had on your Monday show became their own podcast, which I think is awesome. But now you guys have a ton of podcasts. So let me ask you this. Are there more Box to Box podcasts than there have been Handanovic bad mistakes this season so far?
It's a close battle. Yes, we grew as a family because we started to talk to our friends and we started to collect some other podcasts in some ways. We start with the podcast that born from our listeners. So Destinazione Paradiso, it is the podcast about the football from Serie B and down, and then Tunnel that speaks about the international football, but the most obscure parts, and it was the right thing to do to get them in our family. And then we found that we can talk about so many other things, and it's not over. We are already growing. We are just started, but we will grow again soon, because we are talking about, I can unveil this to you, a podcast about tennis, and then we will know.
Well, listen, everything I've heard on Box to Box is superb. You know, doing my yearly appearance with you guys is a huge honor for me. I love talking calcio to you, Giulio. So I'm going to try to bring you on before the end of the season, as I want to hear your thoughts. Keep up the superb work in the meantime, and thanks so much for hopping on, buddy.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You're always so kind.
Always fantastic to hear from Giulia. Now let's get to a part of the podcast for our patrons. If you enjoy hearing us on Friday, on Tuesday, it's just me. We go deep on Serie A. We answer all patron questions. We do our old winners and losers segment, and I give my thoughts on the weekend. If you do enjoy our show on Friday, sometimes we have a guest on there too. I think you will enjoy that. As being a patron, you also get some excellent articles and some tiers, and you get to ask us questions on Friday. Okay, I'm very excited to welcome the next guest. I've had my good friend Matt Lichtenstatter on the pod a few times. He's written some excellent articles on both Di Marzio's site and also on CalcioLand's patron page. Those were more geared towards MLS, either, you know, players to look for in MLS that could head to Italy, or talk about Italian players that headed to MLS. But today we're going to do something a little bit different. Matt's actually a big Spurs fan. And anyone that's been listening to us on CalcioLand for years know that we're not afraid, at least me, to say that we are completely in the Conte cult. So Matt's actually a big Spurs fan. So I'm very curious today to get his take on the Conte experience. So my good friend, it's a real pleasure to welcome you to CalcioLand and the first time to hear your Spurs perspective.
I don't know how many people want to hear that. Because Tottenham and I have a of a fun relationship of getting up at 7:30 in the morning East Coast time to watch them totally screw up and your day's ruined. But, you know, I'm happy to talk about Tottenham in a point where I'm enjoying watching them play again.
Well, yeah. Well, listen, I'll tell you, that's a pretty it's a opposite side of the spectrum on what we get from Alex Goldberg on Spurs. So I think this will work really well.
Well, so he's going through it. You have to give him some credit. He's going through it. His team might be sold to really terrible American ownership. So, you know, you have to give him some sympathy in this difficult time in his life.
He is, and trust me, on this episode, he's also getting a lot of crap from Mendy, so it works really well. But let's get to Conte. So I want to ask you this, my friend. You've auxiliary been following calcio, Italian football, through this podcast. You've collaborated with us. I know you do enjoy that as well. So just tell our listeners, what was your perception of Antonio Conte before he arrived at Spurs?
We know that Conte is obviously one of the best managers in the game right now. I don't think you need to dispute. I don't think anybody's going to dispute that. And of course, you get a good sense of him in Italy. You got a good sense of him at Chelsea with what he did. That was now almost 6 years ago. And again, his CV is unquestionable. I also, of course, we all know about his outbursts, and we've definitely dealt with those. I'd like to call them mental breakdowns, because that's what it felt like to me. Like, his whole world feels like it collapses after he loses a game, particularly some of the games that Tottenham have lost. So I knew all of that was going to be a part of this. And he was linked with Spurs in the summer of 2021. And at the time I was thinking to myself, there's no way. That's not going to happen. Antonio Conte and the way he runs his teams, the way he wants things done, he's not going to get along with the way that Tottenham do business and the way that the chairman does business. And I'm not here to get into a Daniel Levy discussion, because that's another kettle of fish. So I immediately thought in the summer, okay, this isn't going to happen. And then they fire Nuno after El Sacico between Manchester United and Tottenham, the greatest Pyrrhus victory in recent Premier League history for Manchester United, that. And they're linked with Conte, and people are telling me, oh, they're linked with Conte, and I'm skeptical. I'm like, this is not going to happen. It's not. And then the Tottenham journalists start to report it, and you go, is he actually going to take this job? Really? With all that Conte's going to deal with Daniel Levy and Tottenham Hotspur after everything? So my thought was, all right, he must really, really, really need to be back in this sport if he's taking Tottenham in the state he's in. Or the alternate explanation I have, which is Conte's won everywhere he's gone. He doesn't need to prove that anymore. But if he can win at Tottenham, that's a different level of proving my credentials, as opposed to winning at, you know, Juve and winning at Inter and winning at Chelsea when they had unlimited resources. And so winning at Tottenham is a different animal. And so far, he's done a lot of winning at Tottenham with parts that I did not expect much winning with.
Very well said. Very well said. So now you've had the Conte experience for a little bit. You've had a few lows, and we'll get to the lows in a second, but you've had some nice highs with him. So what has surprised you the most about him since he became the Spurs manager?
It surprised me that not only has he gotten his team to play the style he wants very quickly, he's also gotten his team to play the style he wants with players that I didn't think would ever fit in that. And a couple examples. First is Ben Davis, who is a center back who's been at Tottenham now for nearly 7 years. You've seen him play for Wales. He's a decent center back, not great. He's been a defensive, you know, right back at times, or left back. He's not been great. And now here he is as left-sided center back, and he's doing underlapping runs. He's scoring goals off of second phases of set pieces, but he can pass. And in a back three with Conte, your center backs have to be able to pass, and he can pass the ball exceptionally well. I think of a guy like Matt Doherty, who came in from Wolves under Mourinho because Tottenham wanted experience, and Jose Mourinho's agent and Doherty's agent are the same. So he struggled mightily at Tottenham. I didn't understand that transfer very much at the time. Really made less sense the more it went on, and he didn't play. And so he's played a little bit now under Conte. He played at left wing back last week when both of their left wing backs were out, and he was very good. So they're getting the best version of players that I would never have expected him to get the best versions out of. And this is a Frankenstein's monster of a squad. I said it in the piece I wrote. Like, you've got players that are holdover from the best days of Pochettino. You have players who are part of that Mourinho setup from last year. You've got the Paratici guys this year. It's a mishmash. And yet he's somehow been able to make it work. And I'm not saying that this surprises me, because it doesn't, because, you know, Victor Moses, the right wing back where he went to Premier League title, and, you know, Brozovic and all these players who he's made better because he is that good of a manager. But then again, it's that next level of challenge. And he's made Matt Doherty more than tolerable. He's made Ben Davis almost an irreplaceable starter. And even when guys like Romero and Bentancur, Kulusevski weren't around or were injured, he still got them playing really well. I mean, there's the game against Liverpool in December where Tottenham started players and Dele Alli, who's no longer there, Tanguy and Ndombele, who's no longer there. They didn't fit with Conte's vision, and they battered Liverpool to a place where you don't see Klopp Liverpool teams get battered, even though they drew that game. And it shows you what that team was capable of, even with nowhere near what Conte fully wanted in terms of a squad. And it's just amazing to me how quickly they look like a vintage Conte team. And you watch the, just go watch the highlights of the Newcastle game. There's wing back to wing back goals. It looks like peak Conte, and he's been here in Tottenham for, you know, 5 months, and he didn't have a preseason. I think that's pretty incredible.
Well, listen, you know, we love Conte praise on this podcast. It certainly doesn't go unnoticed. So let's look to the opposite side of the spectrum. And I've been thinking a lot about how much do Conte's outbursts at press conferences really matter? And look, you know, I like Conte, so I hold them to lower standards than someone I don't. So I would say that, you know, he's a passionate guy. If he loses, he's going to be really upset. He's going to say things that, you know, in the passion of the moment. And then I think that the last two sporting directors that hired him, which were Marotta at Inter and El Paratici at Spurs, were the two guys he was trashing at Juve, where he was there the most. So that leads me to believe, maybe that stuff doesn't matter that much. So I want to ask you, how much do Conte's outburst after the bad performances that she's had bother you? Do you give a lot of weight to that? Do you think that impacts the team? Or because you've seen some good results, you are willing to look past that?
I think everyone knew, at not just around Tottenham, but particularly the fans, they knew that this was coming. So there was a certain level of being emotionally prepared for it. And yet when he says, maybe I'm not cut out for this job, and you start to see people saying, oh, he might not be at Spurs past this summer, after like losing to Burnley and losing to Southampton, and you start going, okay, what are we doing here? What's going on? Maybe it's one of those things where I don't know whether it's Conte that's truly overreacting and didn't price in the fact that it's a different world you're in when you're at Tottenham and the expectations are different and you're dealing with Daniel Levy, who is famously intransigent at times, or maybe it was Tottenham fans didn't think that he was going to do this in the way that he's done it. And in my view, I can't yet tell, figure out like what is legitimate, like a motivating tactic. What is Conte sending a message to Daniel Levy and Fabio Paratici about the summer and the squad? And what is, you know, fluff? Maybe it's because, you know, Twitter can be a little toxic, and Tottenham fans on Twitter can be very toxic, and a lot of it is scar tissue from the last couple of years. And it's something that I have not yet figured out whether I take it deathly seriously. Maybe if he walks out, I should have done that. Or whether it's one of those things where it's like, this is just part of the Conte experience, and it's the highs and lows of somebody who is, and I'm going to say this in the nicest way possible, the man's a psychopath about soccer. He cares about it arguably too much. So when you get that, you get the very high highs, and then that means the lows also come with it. And I'd like a little bit more emotional balance, especially when the fan base of Tottenham is never really on an even kilter. But it's just one of those weird things where it's something that you kind of have to take it, in my view, where I just go like, if Tottenham loses, I'm just not going to look at Conte's quotes. I'm just going to blow by it and wait until the next game and see what happens.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really, really good policy.
Well, it's also because the Tottenham supporters themselves may not react to it the way that I would react to it. And then you go down that rabbit hole. And once you go down the rabbit hole, you don't get out.
Yeah, very fair. Very fair. So let's talk about three players that are now on Spurs that came from Serie A that would be of interest to our listeners. And they're pretty interesting. So we're going to take them a little bit separately. Let's start with Romero, because Romero was one of the best defenders in Serie A the last season he was there at Atalanta. You know, he moved, especially now with Conte, to a system that he's pretty familiar with. So what do you make of Romero so far? How would you rate his time at Spurs since he joined?
I'll say that I find it hard to find four or five center backs in the Premier League that have been better than him when he's played. Like, the two best Premier League center backs are Ruben Diaz and Virgil van Dijk. You can pick the order you want for those two. But you'd have a hard time convincing me that somebody is not Christian Romero's number three. The things he has been able to do when he's healthy are remarkable. His grace on the ball is great. Obviously, you need to be able to pass if you're playing in a back three. And you'll see him marauding forward, looking like a midfielder at times. But the craziness of him is how he is, at moments, completely insane, goes in, makes wild challenges, and somehow never goes beyond the line. A challenge that looks like it's completely ridiculous, he somehow just does enough to not get a yellow card. Just does enough to not get a red if it's a yellow card challenge. He'll make challenges that are just, like, incredible. And the one thing that Tottenham's had success with in recent years is center backs. Ludley King was obviously great when he was fit. They had Toby Alderweireld and Jan Vertonghen at their peak, and you'd be hard-pressed to find a better center back tandem than those two at their peak. And Romero's just been remarkable. He was good in a back four, too, when it was Nuno, and that team was really not very good, but Romero stood out quite a bit. And in this system, obviously, he's perfect for it. And you get people at Tottenham who I think sometimes don't appreciate some of these players and like their instant impact, or are selling it a little short because you fear that if you sell it a little too high, then maybe other clubs are going to get interested and then they buy the player. And then that's not what we want, obviously. But Romero is incredible. When he's on his game, he'll make challenges that are breathtakingly good. And you start to wonder, like, is he, if he can continue to improve, he's 23, 24 in that range, then you start talking like best center back in the world kind of stuff. That's what the potential is. And he's already been exceptionally good. And Tottenham were decent when he wasn't in the lineup, but when he's been playing, it's just, he's so noticeable in a good way every time he plays. It's remarkable how good he is. And it's remarkable to me that other teams that are in a better position than Spurs didn't get to him first.
Well, you know, I think it really helped the sporting director, but I hear what you say. I mean, Paratici had actually bought him before, but yeah, very good points there. So I want to ask you about the next two players, and these to me are a little bit different because Romero was considered, at least at Atalanta, one of the best center backs in Serie A when he moved over. But on the other hand, Bentancur and Kulusevski, I mean, if you scroll down Juve Twitter, people were really down on them. And I think there was some good reason for them to a certain extent. Now, I don't know how much the players are to blame, especially with Kulusevski. But in any event, they get to Spurs. I don't know how much it's Conte or whatnot. But what's interesting to me is we often talk about levels of leagues. And I think it's undeniable that the Premier League has a lot more good players and good teams than Serie A. But then I also wonder, you know, is that more important than the system and the manager a player has? And I'm not surprised that Bentancur and Kulusevski have thrived under Conte. So tell us a little bit about them. What has been your impression on these two players?
Well, it's funny because the transfer window, you see Tottenham linked with big names, Luis Diaz, which was essentially we're making Liverpool pay more for him than they would have paid in the summer. And Tottenham fans get frustrated with that. And then by the end of the window, you say, oh, it's these two guys from Juve that Paratici knows. And so you go, okay, these are not bad signings. These are good players. But, I mean, Tottenham, the expectation is a little higher now. When you sign Conte, you expect to be in a different market of player. And what I find interesting about these two is, and I'll start with Bentancur first, and I gave the Christian Eriksen example in the story because Eriksen obviously played for Conte at Inter. Tottenham fans still think of midfielders like Christian Eriksen as, you know, like that, not I would say gold standard, but as the kind of midfielder that they need, the lock picking number 10, you know, this individual brilliance of creativity. And for Conte, you don't really need that. Conte doesn't want that. Obviously, Eriksen's case, he molded his game around what Conte asked him to do. And that's why he ended up succeeding, because Conte didn't want him initially. Because, yeah, Conte's system is so specific, you don't really get a lot of freelancing. You don't get a lot of freestyling in that. And so that's what Tottenham fans still think about. And then here comes Bentancur, and everybody's saying they need more creativity in midfield. And then when you see Bentancur play, just slots right in, you wonder how he doesn't succeed at Juve. And then in my mind, I look at it, I say, this is exactly what Conte needed, because the things he does helps keep the tempo high. He helps move the ball to where it needs to go in terms of the patterns of play, in terms of, you know, the passing rotations, all of this. And he's really good at it. He keeps the tempo, as I said, where it needs to be. And he's just an upgrade on Harry Winks in doing that. And no offense to Harry Winks. Conte likes Harry Winks because he can pass, but he just, his grace on the ball is there. His ability to read the game in that system is wonderful. And he's elevated the midfield in a time when you need to be able to pass and get those passes out. And he's not going to directly contribute to goals, but he's going to be a huge instrumental part in the passing moves that lead to that pass and that leads to a goal. It's like three or four hockey assists before you get to that move. And so he's been really helpful in the midfield in that way, specifically because Oliver Skip, who's a good young midfielder for Tottenham, has some of those attributes, has been injured and just hasn't played all that much. And that stinks. I want to see a Bentancur Skip midfield at some point. And Kulusevski, I can't think of an attacking player that's had more of an instant impact for Tottenham since Dele Alli in 2015. Like, a lot of their attacking signings have taken time to figure out what they are. Son didn't hit the ground running immediately. Eric Lamella, it took a while for Eric Lamella to become the Eric Lamella we know, but obviously Lo Celso and Ndombele, it took them time. Lucas Moura, it took him time. Kulusevski's great because, as I say about Lucas Moura, he does one thing really well, and that one thing doesn't really fit Conte's 3-4-3 particularly well. And you can see the limitations of that when Lucas was playing on the right next to Kane and Son. And when Kulusevski's playing, his ability to not just pass, but to combine with his teammates, to know where everyone is, and to involve himself in the move in a way that makes Kane and Son's jobs easier is really incredible. And Kulusevski's been great. Obviously, Kane and Son are on mass eaters right now, and that's a lot of why Tottenham's winning, because those two are world-class and they're playing at their best form. But Kulusevski's helped unlock their abilities to do that, because he fits exactly into what Conte wants in that wide forward. His creativity's there. He can cross. He gets into those positions. Again, it's not that he's a fast player, but he always knows what to do with the ball in those tight areas and tight spaces. And that has made Tottenham's front three work even better. And for a long time, it was just Kane and Son. And then Lucas would come in. You'd get a Lucas burst here and there, but he wouldn't do what Kulusevski's capable of doing in that front three. And it's a player that somehow immediately upgraded on a spot that everyone knew needed an upgrade, but nobody knew exactly what that upgrade could be. And he's massively upgraded it. And now all three guys are first name on the team sheet kind of additions. And I can't think of the last time I've seen that for Spurs, where signings instantly raise the level of a team in a way that normally it takes time. And Paratici's had some misses, obviously, in some signings, but these three have been great. And so I always wonder when I'm looking at it, like, I know Juve is difficult. Like, it's not an easy place to win. It's not an easy place to thrive. How did they not thrive at Juve? What went wrong there to the point where it's going so right at Tottenham? And Kulusevski's already got a really, really great song from the Tottenham fans, Ginger from Sweden. If you haven't heard it, listen to it. Like, he's been beloved in like 2 months. That does not happen very often.
Well, listen, I'll tell you, I think Conte has a ton to do with that. I also think fit and formations. And I think you're right. Juve has not been the easiest place for players to fit in. All right. Want to close the show talking a little bit about Jerry Cantrell and Alice in Chains. I went to see him live on Wednesday. Awesome venue in Boston called Big Night Live. Interestingly, Jerry Cantrell, who is the lead guitarist, and he sings quite a few of Alice in Chains' most famous songs. I saw him the day after the 20th anniversary of Layne Staley's death, and he was the lead singer in Alice in Chains. I absolutely loved Layne. I thought there's so many great singers from the 90s. I always say, to me, he always sounded like the most raw and authentic. What I mean by that is I feel like you could just wake him up from a coma and have him sing a song, and it would sound really, really awesome. And you could just really hear the passion in his voice. And look, you know, not a lot of bands have recovered from, you know, a iconic singer like that passing away. And I got to give a lot of credit to Jerry Cantrell. Lane Staley died because of his demons. You know, Alice in Chains had just a way of writing these beautiful songs about the most, you know, the darkest subjects. And a lot of it was about drug addiction. And Lane Staley, you know, died to those demons. And I give a lot of credit to Jerry Cantrell. He got sober right around that time. He's been sober a long time. Still carries the Alice in Chains legacy incredibly well. I've seen him with the band, their new singer, William Duvall. Quite good, but not quite as good as Lane, but few would be, if anyone. And that sounds really good. And he's been touring solo. I like all his albums solo, too. And I really respect someone turn their life around. And that catalog of songs is really, really awesome. You know, I know the singer in Slipknot, not a band that I follow. I remember when he said last year that, you know, if you really think about it, no band from the 90s, the grunge era, has a catalog quite like Alice in Chains. And I do agree. I mean, their discography from the 90s is flawless. So, you know, I think it's a great story of perseverance, of getting over your demons. So I really enjoyed hearing Jerry Cantrell. If you're looking to listen to some music, check out his new record. It's really excellent. So I want to thank all you guys for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this, consider becoming a patron or leave us a review on iTunes. I read all of them. You can give us 5 stars on Spotify to help spread the word on the pod. So I hope everyone has a great weekend and look forward to chatting with you next week.